Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Microsoft Senior Vice President, Windows Server, Bob Muglia.
PDC Day 3. Welcome to PDC Day 3, Server Day. This morning we're going to talk about servers. In particular, we're going to talk about Windows Server and where we're going for the next 3 years. What I want to do here is give you a platform-guided tour at a taste of Windows Server for the next 3 years. Now, there's a lot of things that are coming in Windows Server. We've got releases coming about every 6 months that will impact developers. Now, there's a ton of additional functionality that we're delivering that affects other audiences, a lot of things for IT as well. But we're not going to cover that today. Today, I just want to talk about the platform and the way the platform is going to evolve. And that evolution really starts now as we move into the end of 05 with the next release of Windows Server, Windows Server 2003 R2. What are we doing with R2? Well, what we were doing is we're building an interim release that adds functionality on top of 2003, adds a wide range of features, a lot of great stuff in here, branch office, replication, whole set of great functionality being added to Windows Server 2003 to really enhance the overall experience. But there's some key things in R2 for developers, and that's what I want to focus on. First, the one that is unambiguously the most important, the one that will probably impact the most people here and the most people who develop for Windows, is the .NET framework, the 2.0 version, which we're shipping in R2. So, of course, it's all the things that you've been hearing about, all the things that are being delivered with Visual Studio. But it's just being included in the R2 release of Windows Server. So as customers deploy new versions of servers or upgrade them to R2, this will just be there, and you can count on it as a standard operating system service. But there is a lot more that we're doing. We're doing things around storage, in particular making it easier to connect to SANs in this release, making it more straightforward to take Windows Server and storage-based applications and configure and connect to SANs with VDS 1.1. Active Directory has a key new feature. I'll talk more about Active Directory and the future of how Active Directory is going to unfold over the next few years. But I want to put a little focus on what's coming now, which is Federation services. And this is an open protocol, WS Federation, and an open set of services that allow Active Directory systems to federate and user accounts to be authenticated based on the credentials that exist within a partner organization. Great feature for IT, lots of developer opportunity with this feature of Active Directory, lots more to come with Active Directory. Another thing I want to highlight in R2 is our Unix interoperability, putting a lot of focus on helping developers who have Unix applications move them on top of the Windows platform without having to rewrite the whole thing. The new services for Unix, which are included in R2, really provides a subsystem to simplify that development and that porting, allowing for Unix-based semantics to be included in the applications. A lot of great features here, a lot of great Unix utilities for Unix administrators. One thing I want to highlight here is the database interoperability. The biggest and most difficult problem that developers who have built applications on Unix and want to move them onto Windows have faced is how to integrate their Oracle and other databases into the platform. And we now have services to allow for that connectivity directly, so a big step forward. Other features in R2 that impact developers. WS Management, a new standards-based protocol. We just submitted that protocol. Actually, it's being announced today to DMTF for standardization. This is a protocol where there's been a lot of industry rallying around it. Companies like Intel and others are working with us to build WS Management capability directly into the hardware. But you can take and extend WMI-based applications with WS Management as well, allowing for heterogeneous management. This is, when we think about heterogeneity, we think about how open protocols connect to other systems. Having an upgraded management protocol that's secure and web services based is critical, and that's what WS Management's all about. Another really important thing coming in R2 is the next generation of the Microsoft Management Console, MMC 3.0. Now, for the last 10 years or so, there has been a quandary in management and what to do. If you take a look at applications that have been built, server-based applications that need management consoles, what have you chosen to do? Well, some people have chosen to write to MMC, and that provides some integration benefits, but frankly, today's MMC consoles aren't all that great. And it doesn't provide the level of heterogeneous support that developers want or that customers want, IT wants. Some applications have chosen to go the least common denominator approach and build a web application. And that works, certainly, from anywhere, but it isn't a very rich experience. And a lot of people have chosen Java because it seems to provide a balance across the board. But it has a lot of trade-offs and compromises, too. Well, MMC 3.0 provides us the first step to a no-compromise management experience on Windows. The key to MMC 3.0 is it enables you to write a managed code .NET application. So it's incredibly straightforward to build an MMC 3.0 app. Since we've introduced this at Microsoft, we have had an explosion of MMC work going on across the server organization, with developers building really great management consoles very, very rapidly. It's incredibly straightforward. We have updated guidelines, which will go on the web shortly, to talk about what these consoles should look like. The next step to really provide the heterogeneous support, though, is coming in Longhorn. And that's when we take Terminal Server and we allow for application remoting. So you can take any server, any Windows server in Longhorn, and be able to take an application and remote it to another machine. Now, that's great for Terminal Server applications. But for management, it's also great because it means that you can run the management console remotely with just having the remote desktop client present on the client machine. We also will have a gateway in Longhorn to allow this to go through firewalls. So really what that means is that with MMC3, you can build a console that runs anywhere. So it's a good step. Another really important thing that starts at this time frame, it's separate from R2, but it's really being delivered in the 2005 time frame, so I want to put a focus on it, is SDM, the System Definition Model, and the work that's being done integrating with Visual Studio. We've talked about how models will change the way management works. Models provide, for the first time, a clear description of what an application is. It's the first time that developers can specify all the components of an application and their relationship. Visual Studio 2005 provides the foundation to allow that to be built. And now we're working with partners to take those models and be able to turn those into really complete solutions that close the loop between operations and development. This is the first key step in that delivery of SDM. And with that, what I'd like to do is invite Dmitry Nikolov to come up to show us how partners like MacroVision and AviCode have taken and built on SDM and Visual Studio to close that loop. Dmitry.
Thank you, Bob. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
What you see on your screen right now is an application diagram, which is a visual representation of an SDM model. And this represents an insurance company that has a call center application, which is a Windows application, that connected to Web Services Action Manager, where policy actions are recorded, and Unified Management, which is your interface to legacy systems, to Live System and Auto System. What you can do with it, developer now can specify how and what will be monitored in your application by placing a MOM management pack on your application diagram. Now, this MOM management pack is designed by one of our partners, AviCode, and allows you to produce and configure the actual MOM pack on the MOM server.
So what this is really an app. Essentially, what you're laying out through this visual diagram is an SDM model. And what AviCode has done is they've taken and extended that by enabling a management pack to be built directly.
Yes, through the SDM extensibility SDK, they extended it, and now you can specify what kind of exceptions and performance you want this application to be monitored for, such as what functionality types and entry points. And by default, all the entry points are included, and, you know, system web UI page process request is one of them.
So you can set the thresholds, which would actually trigger an event to be sent to MOM or operations to be monitored and then an alert to be raised.
Yes, exactly that. And on the logical data center diagram, you can specify where the MOM pack will be generated and what kind of binding type, which really means whether you're going to do the WMA instrumentation or Windows event log events.
Great.
And, of course, you can set up tons of other settings. So the next logical step is prepare my application for deployment, and I'm just going to map everything on my deployment diagram. So now I'm mapping my MOM pack to the MOM server, and all the other applications map to the respective logical servers.
So then once you've done that, you're really ready to take and create an SDM deployment-based deployment report that really describes all of these attributes, the characteristics of an app, and helps a developer to really lay out for operations what this app consists of. It helps from a documentation perspective.
Yes, it's a great reference tool. It's a great documentation tool. It also creates files you really need to, for deployment, which is your binaries for Windows applications, content files for web applications, and whatever Windows project output groups contain. And this is an example of that deployment report.
And then from that, you can directly generate a management pack.
Absolutely, yes. So once we created the deployment report and verified that our application can be deployed, we should actually do the actual deployment. And our partner MacroVision has designed this great add-in, MacroVision Install Shield Packager for distributed applications. It will take input from our SDM. It will take input from our deployment report, which I'm going to specify right now. It's going to take the files that were generated by the deployment report, and I'm going to specify a directory.
So really, for the first time, when the developer is laying out and building the application, all of the relationships, the deployment characteristics are included inside the application. And then what MacroVision is doing here is taking and creating the MSI install packages. And they can actually create ones for developers to use, for tests to use in a test deployment, and then for production across multiple servers.
Yes, and they created by separating them in a logical server grouping, so developers can deploy them in their development environment on a single box, testers can deploy them in a test environment, or they can be pushed through MacroVision Admin Studio to SMS for enterprise-wide deployment.
So this is the development side of this. Let's take a look at what happens from an error reporting side on the back end when the user's actually running the application.
So once those MSIs are built and deployed, this call center application is an example of that deployment. So I'm going to put some data for the claim number, and I'm going to put, you know, FI123. I'm going to populate some claim data and try to get some user actions.
Now, this error that's generated here is actually an error that's being run on the back-end service. So that error is an error within the production server application, and that's being picked up, of course, by MOM based on what we just did in the SDM model.
Now, because we designed SDM model in a way that allows us to track four major kinds of errors, application faults, application performance faults, connectivity and security faults, operations can clearly see that this is an application fault, so developers should be notified about that. They should know about it.
So the connection, there's actually a connection here between the operations console and the developer Visual Studio, and then the developer can go in and actually see that, in fact, an error has been raised, and then take a look and find out where that error occurred.
Take a look at the diagram. Now, Action Manager has the red sign in it. So developer now knows that this application, for some reason, had a problem.
Now, it would be interesting to be able to take that problem and go deeper and figure out where the problem existed. What was the event that caused it and where the code was that caused the actual problem?
AviCode has integrated with Visual Studio by providing the Intercept plugin. And what I can see here now, it tells me that there was a PDC test exception that occurred at 8:40 a.m. this morning on this machine and in this specific ASMX. And obviously, this information is not enough for a developer to debug the issue.
Right. They need to be able to actually get in and see what happened from a code perspective.
And that's what we do now. We have the entire exception chain they can trace. We have the complete stack they can trace. We know now the parameters, this STR claim number, FI123, that I just passed to this function, local variables if there are any. And finally, they can actually jump to the source code. Here we show the snippet of the source code, but if I click on the link, it will open the actual source file for you to develop and highlight the line where the error occurred.
Great. So that's closing the loop. We've been talking about closing the loop between developer and operations, and I think with Visual Studio 2005 and this great work from some of our partners, we're really seeing it happen.
Yes, definitely that's the case, and we are providing now. Now you can take it, you can fix it, and you can run through this loop to redeploy it back to your production environment again.
Thank you, Dimitri. Thanks.
You're welcome, Bob.
So from a developer perspective, that's really our first major deliverable on SDM, and I think it's a very important step forward. We're going to continue this process. We feel that closing the loop between developers and operational systems, there's tremendous amount of work that's left to be done here, but we see real progress happening now and things that you can take advantage of. Okay, so that's this year, 2005. Those are things that are coming very, very shortly. Let's move and talk about the things that are coming next year. A couple major things. We have a new product, a new member of the Windows Server family that we're introducing next year, the Compute Cluster Edition. We're doing some work, and we'll be releasing in our first release of Monad, our command line scripting language. And then WinFX comes out coincident with Vista, and of course there is a redistributable for that that runs on Windows Server 2003 at the time that Vista ships. So a lot of things coming next year in addition to our client work, a lot of things are coming next year to affect the server. Let me start by talking about compute clusters. In the scientific computing marketplace, there have been a set of there's a very large number of these things that are getting installed. There's a good set of ISVs that are building applications. It's a thriving ISV community, and they're really solving compute-intensive problems for engineering organizations, oil and gas, pharmaceutical, financial, government, universities. All sorts of different scenarios are being solved. And up to now, really, the focus on this has largely been on the Linux platform. The reason is that a complete solution set has not been delivered by Microsoft to pull this together on Windows. And while Linux is working for some of these situations, there are some trade-offs and some drawbacks. They're not integrated. The apps are not integrated into the company's business environment. They tend to be built on a one-off basis, so there's not a lot of consistency. The parts kind of have to be pulled together. And so that we've heard from ISVs that there are real support issues associated with this. So what we're doing next year, first half of next year, is releasing a version of Server 2003 that's targeted at the engineering and scientific computing market, the compute-intensive market. The focus is to build a complete platform that has the set of services that are required to write applications that target this market. Many of those applications are open source. Many are delivered by ISVs in this space, and some are built in-house by companies and universities. But our goal is to build a complete platform here. The idea is you can take a cluster of machines. We're building a cluster-based solution where you might take a very small cluster of, say, 4 to 8 machines, or a larger cluster of 32, 64, 128 machines. Good-sized clusters. These are, you know, when you think about dual-core systems, these are machines with a lot of capability given today's hardware. But take a cluster of machines, be able to take applications, submit a job to that to the cluster solution, have that job run across the different sets of machines. Some of those applications will require tight communications, so a high-performance MPI-based memory stack to messaging stack to connect applications together. Some don't require that tight coupling, but allow for that level of flexibility and deliver a complete solution that integrates with the business environment, that works with Active Directory, that can be developed and designed with Visual Studio, and gets all the benefits of Windows. We think the ecosystem is ready for this. We're very excited about this opportunity. And with that, what I'd like to do is invite... Before I say, the beta of that is available now. The beta of that is, we just went to our first beta, and that's available on Microsoft.com, HPC, so we're starting this process. We have major things coming later this year. And with that, what I'd like to do is invite Kirill Fanoff up to show us a demo of the compute cluster solution.
Hey, Bob.
Kirill, good morning.
How are you doing? So you mentioned financial services as an example of an application. What I wanted to show is an application that can take advantage of compute clusters. Excel Client has been used as an application platform in financial services, and here we have an example app that models the risk of an options portfolio using Monte Carlo simulation. So this spreadsheet has about 50,000 rows and takes several minutes to run, with results then being displayed in this sheet. So Excel Client over time has become a very popular platform for developing applications. And we know of companies that have tens of thousands of spreadsheets encompassing their applications. And with Excel Services functionality in Office 12 next year, you now will be able to run these same worksheets on the server, taking advantage of server capabilities. And Compute Cluster Solution can provide scalable and highly available pool of computing resources for this application. So let's see what that would look like. So instead of putting input directly into the Excel client, you have a web part where just the input parameters can be specified. You can request specific output parameters and click Submit. At this point, the web part contacts a computational cluster and submits a job on one of the available resources. That same spreadsheet that you just saw is running on one of the compute nodes in the cluster. Actually, it's a cluster right here of 4 nodes. So the results will be rendered right back here into the web part after it executes on the compute node. So here we see the results, and just the results you want to see are rendered.
Now, I mean, in most industries, the applications for compute-intensive solutions are developed by third parties. But in the financial services space, Excel is really popular.
Exactly. So let's take a look at what's going on in the cluster. So right now, we have 2 nodes handling load, you can see on a performance monitor, And if you look at the queue, you have two jobs that are running and a bunch more are queued. So you might imagine that you want to grow the capacity of this cluster to increase its throughput. So let's bring online a pre-provisioned node that will immediately jump in and start taking the load, improving the throughput of the cluster. You saw it took the load, so now we have, if we refresh that, so now we now have three jobs running in parallel. So clearly, this is a mission-critical application. A failure is not an option. So Bob, what I'm going to ask you to do is unplug one of these machines.
Okay.
Okay. Bob just unplugged the network connection. And the job scheduler for the compute cluster right now is monitoring through heartbeats the compute nodes. And when it senses the failure, what it will do, it will re-queue the job that was running on the failed node and put it at the top of the queue to submit and run it on top of the next resource that becomes available. So this takes a few seconds because of the heartbeat mechanism, and we see the node becomes unreachable. And when we look at the console, the job is, it'll get re-queued.
So the job was pulled off that and it just re-queues.
Exactly. It re-queues on top of the job, the queue. So what I want to show next is how easy it is to integrate this advanced functionality of talking to the cluster into your application. So let's look at the source code for the web part that we just saw. So right after you click the submit button, here's the code required to integrate with the cluster. Here you create the configuration and you connect to the cluster, you create the job, you specify the resources that are required to run this job, and this is the job that will run on the cluster. Right here, you add the task, you submit the job, and then set the credential. When the job will run, it will take advantage of Active Directory to run as the user that submitted the job. So now administrators will be able to use the same policy and security mechanism they already have applied.
That's actually a pretty big deal, too, for a lot of these companies, because up to now, these compute clusters based on Linux have to run outside of the credential management system of their company, and they really need to be treated as separate islands. And just getting at resources, we've heard from customers we've talked to, is a real problem.
Exactly. And so with this, you can integrate advanced cluster functionality very easily in your application. I'd like to invite you to stop by the hands-on lab. We actually have a cluster there where you can try your hand in writing parallel applications using compute cluster solution. And with that solution next year, we'll make it easy for developers to take their compute-intensive apps and scale their functionality across the cluster, and easy for IT professionals to deploy and administer these clusters.
That's great. Thanks, Kiel.
Thanks a lot, Bob.
Thanks, Kiel. As Kiel showed, there's not a tremendous amount of developer additions that are required for compute cluster addition. The real key is to take this class of applications, these scientific and compute-intensive applications, and have them run on the Windows platform. And our goal is to provide a complete solution, platform solution, where those applications can be built. We think it's a great new market opportunity. It's a great growing part of the server market, and we're really glad to be bringing out a solution here. So now let's talk about Monad. Monad is a object-based command language that's been under development for a while. We've spent a lot of time trying to understand the needs that, in particular, IT has to build command scripts and what the management issues are. And what we've done is we've built really a next-generation scripting language that's focused on meeting those needs. Monad has a lot of great capabilities, the most important of which is that it's built on the .NET framework and it's integrated with all of the services that are there. So when you want to take your application and write management extensions, write management commands to it, it's possible to do that and build that using standard .NET code. And the key thing that Monad does, the thing that Monad delivers is this object-based orientation. It's really, in a sense, the first command language, mainstream command language, that's focused on allowing objects with the full set of services that an object possesses, events and methods, and pass those things between different commands. The key, from your perspective, you just take and build a .NET object that focuses on the management side, and then put a little bit of extra things in there to define this commandlet. And from that, a very thorough set of commands can be generated to do command line-based management. We are going to undergo a project over the next few years to get a full set of Monad commands across all of Windows Server and across all of our server applications. As we move forward, our design point for building management tools, the MMC-based consoles, the GUI consoles, will be to take these graphical consoles and have them call the same .NET objects that are used for Monad. So one set of underlying management objects can provide a very consistent set of capabilities for both the graphical administration as well as for command line. We really think this will take a gigantic leap forward in terms of the manageability of Windows Server. And I am explicitly asking your help. This is one where I really want your help in terms of building these objects, these management objects, building these commandlets to make your server-based applications administrable. So I look forward to that. It's a really important step from a management perspective, and I think it's a great opportunity. WinFX. A lot's been talked about at this conference on WinFX, and I'm going to focus on really the identity side here. But there's many, many attributes of WinFX that affect the server very, very deeply. The ones I'll focus on are inside this communications box. And this has been discussed in a lot of depth, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about the Windows Communication Foundation or the Windows Workflow Foundation. Both of those are things that have been discussed in keynotes and have been discussed throughout this PDC. Suffice it to say, these are core foundational services upon which our servers are going to be built in the future. When we look at new protocols we are introducing, we are building WS Star protocols. We are building them on top of Windows Communication Foundation. One of the core reasons why these services are in the operating system is we are going to use them ubiquitously. We're going to use them to build operating system services. We'll use them to build our Microsoft server applications. And, of course, they're therefore available for you to use as you build applications on top of these things. The Communications Foundation is a very critical component. It is a revolutionary component to make it straightforward to extend applications and speak using a standards-based heterogeneous protocol. And with incredible sets of services such as message queuing and transactions and security, having all those things built in. Workflow Foundation really builds into the platform core workflow services to be enabled across a wide set of applications. If you look at business apps, all of them have workflow in it. Even within Windows Server, we have many things that require workflow. Having a standard platform, the Windows Workflow Foundation on this is critical. So these are key things. But the one I really want to focus on today is identity and Active Directory. Active Directory is an incredibly important part of what we provide to our customers, both developers and IT. All these things, all services, in a sense, all services that an operating system provides are critical. But in some senses, identity and security is the most critical because everything is built on top of that. Everything has to use it. You know, when we introduced Active Directory 5 years ago, the problem space that our customers had was how do they take and get single sign-on across their enterprise. Active Directory has largely solved that problem. When we go out and survey our customers, 75% of enterprise customers use Active Directory as their primary authentication system. They may have other authentication systems. In fact, all enterprises have some other authentication system. But when users log in every day, when services run, they are being authenticated by Active Directory. What this means, and this is growing, by the way, it's growing at an incredibly rapid rate. What this means is that from your perspective, you can count on Active Directory to be there to provide you identity and authorization services. And so when you're building an application, you need to think about, gee, how can I get a certificate out there? Active Directory is the answer. If you want, and if you want to use smart cards and credential management, Active Directory is the answer. If you want to protect the rights of a document, of something that's being created, and have claims be put on that are more sophisticated than just an ACL, rights management services is an answer there. I talked about earlier how federation services, we're introducing that for cross-company, partner-based authentication. That's available. Meta directory services to connect to other systems, whether they be HR systems or other directory services. Those are available. Those are now all built in just a standard part of what's on top of that single sign-on capability that we introduced 5 years ago. And these are services that should be taken advantage of. It's an incredibly unfortunate thing when we look at systems that our customers have to deploy and they have to maintain separate user accounts and passwords. That's a mistake. If you have an app, even if you want to keep your own database, integrate with Active Directory. Make that an option for your customers so they can have one place to do authentication. This is something which is available to developers today. It makes a difference for customers. It will differentiate your product because right now the marketplace is littered with all kinds of different authentication systems, and no customer is happy about that. Active Directory is the answer. But moving forward, there's more that needs to be done. We look forward to what's happening in the identity space, and it's no longer just about single sign-on. It's about compliance and dealing with the HIPAA and all the different regulations that are out there. It's about B2B transactions and online commerce, how to do that securely, and how to ensure the privacy. You think about identity theft. It's one of the key issues that companies face today, and one of the most embarrassing things that can happen to a company is to have their customers' identities be stolen. Authentication, which is password-based, is not secure. We need to move away from these things. And we need to do so in a way that simplifies the deployment cost and complexity. Well, we're focusing on evolving Active Directory to meet those needs and to build a common set of services that developers can use to take and create solutions that leverage the identity capabilities of Active Directory. So think about these services as implicit in the Windows Server platform. Think about capabilities like access control and auditing, credentials management, certificate-based distribution, all of those things as intrinsics that Windows can provide. And then as you build applications, you can take advantage of those things. You can take advantage whether you're writing to Win32 or whether you're writing to WinFX, and of course whether you're using a standard protocol like LDAP or the WS Star-based protocols. So the goal here is to take and expand out what Active Directory can do, and to provide these services in a way that all developers can take advantage of. Now, let me highlight one service here that's new, that's perhaps new to you. That's the security token service. This is the service that will provide really the back-end capability to info cards that Jim showed earlier this week. So this is our implementation of a security token service for info cards. It'll come sometime after Longhorn ships. But of course, info cards were designed in a way such that other STSs can plug in as well in heterogeneous systems. But clearly, we're making an investment in allowing those credentials to be managed as well. With that, what I'd like to do is invite Dave Martinez up to give us a demonstration of Active Directory so Dave can show some of the things that are being developed here. Dave.
Hi, Bob. How you doing? Hi, everyone. So as Bob was saying, identity and access management has always been an important topic. But with the emergence of connected systems, where the services we write could theoretically be connected to by anyone or anything with an internet connection, how we control access to those services and to their data becomes even more critical. Now, in the service-oriented world, identity can be just another service. And in fact, with Active Directory, we provide a rich set of identity services that we make easy for developers to leverage through WinFX, and today's demonstration is to show off how we might do that.
That really is an important point. When you think about both the standard-based protocols like WS Star and WinFX, we have a wide variety of services that we're providing. And in a web services world, there's lots of different kinds of services. Identity is just one of those services, and that's the way we're evolving and building Active Directory.
That's exactly right. So today in our demonstration, I'm going to be with Fabricam, and we've written an order management application. It's actually composed of two parts, a smart client and a service, both of which were written using WinFX, which is going to be available in the Vista timeframe. So if I go ahead and I start the client as a Fabricam employee, the first thing that you'll notice about the app is that I don't have to log on. And the reason is because the application is leveraging Windows integrated authentication to provide single sign-on. Now, users don't have to have a separate password for accessing this application. Now, an interesting question that might come up here is, how much work did I have to do to actually make this possible? In the past, this has been possible with Windows Integrated Auth.
Right.
Now, using WinFX, that process can actually be made so that it doesn't require any specific code. So if I go into Visual Studio here, I can actually show you my service. You can see here that I don't have any security code in my interface definition. If I scroll through here a little bit, you'll see I have no security code really in my implementation either. And that's because I'm declaring everything in configuration. So if I go ahead and close this out here, you'll see that I've specifically set my web service to use the WSHTTP binding, which uses message-level security by default, and leverages Windows Integrated Authentication. And since I'm setting all this setting, the security declaratively in config, if there's any reason why I have to change the security in the future, I can do so easily without having to recompile and redeploy.
So if IT decides they want to change the way they're providing security services, those things can be done just through configuration files, not through having to go back and change the code. The code is isolated from that.
Exactly right. And in fact, a good example of that would be, let's say that I wanted to federate this application with a business partner. would I have to do a lot of code management for that? Well, the answer is no, because what we actually have done here is we've added a new binding called a federated binding to our config file. What this means is that my service can now trust an identity service over at our partner, in this case, Contoso. Now, you may be wondering, what is an identity service? It's what Bob was talking about before. It's a security token service, or STS. For federated users to get access to my application, they need to provide a security token from an STS that my service trusts, in this case, the Contoso employee STS. Now, Contoso has the option. They could use Active Directory to generate the security tokens with the Active Directory STS, or they could use any WS Star compliant identity service. Now, how does my application actually get the security token? Well, for that, I actually want to go ahead and show you an experience here. Let me go ahead and close this out. What I'm going to do is I'm going to switch to an instance of the order management application that is configured for use by Contoso employees. So when I click here on Contoso order entry, the smart client is going to contact my service, and the service is going to request a security token from their STS. Now, Contoso could have just chosen to use usernames and passwords to protect the STS, but instead, did something else. They decided to leverage InfoCard, the new client-side technology available in the Vista timeframe, that enables users to select the appropriate identity for use with different applications, while at the same time providing a secure alternative to usernames and passwords. So you can see here that through web services protocols, first, InfoCard, and WinFX, go ahead and read the access policy of my service. Then what they do is they match that security policy to the different identities available for a different user. The grayed out card here is an instance of an identity service that can't meet the security requirements of my service. But the Contoso card here, which is not grayed out, can, because of the federated arrangement that's set up between Contoso and Fabric.
And because this isn't a username password, that's a much more secure certificate-based card.
Absolutely. If I go ahead and I select on the card and click Submit, again using web services, InfoCard and WinFX go get a security token from Contoso's STS, and they pass that security token to the service using a cryptographic key in lieu of a username and a password.
Right.
So now that I've done that, and I might ask the question, okay, on the client side, how much work did I have to do in the app to manage all this InfoCard interaction? Well, again, like the answer before, with WinFX, I can abstract a lot of this out of the code. So if I go ahead and I bring back up Solution Explorer, and I go take a look at the config file for the partner instance of my service, you can see that here's where I've identified the federation binding for communicating with the actual service, and here's where I've set up InfoCard to be the credential type that I'll use for my STS. All of the other stuff that happened, including getting the security tokens, reading policies, passing them to the service, etc., is all handled for me.
Right, because it's handled by the services, the identity-based services we're creating, and you're just using standard WinFX calls to get to them.
To get to them, exactly. So we talked a little bit about how we've used WinFX and AD to control access to my application. But what about information that's inside of my application, particularly when that information is no longer under the control of my app or even of my organization? So, like, for example, if I bring up the app, you'll see that one of the features in it is this view price list feature, and that generates a custom price list that we consider sensitive information. We wouldn't want Contoso, for example, to share that information with our competitors. But is there anything we can do to actually control how they use that data? Well, in fact, there is, using the information protection capabilities provided by Rights Management Services, or RMS. If I go ahead and come back here, let me go ahead and show you where I actually protect my price list document. I'm using the systems.security.rightsmanagementassembly in WinFX to actually protect this document, which literally creates a series of, we'll call them usage licenses, that we append to the document that correspond to the entitlements of the person requesting the document.
And the document itself, RMS actually encrypts the document, and those entitlements have to be satisfied. The claims have to be satisfied in order for the document to go back into a clear form.
Exactly. And when we look at a document is actually received by the user, so let me go ahead and actually click View Price List, one thing that you'll notice is that we use the XPS document sharing format in this case, in part because of its rich integration with RMS. So you can see here in the XPS viewer, we can see that there is, in fact, rights protection on this document. If I drill in a little bit, you'll see that it tells me that I have the right to view the document. But, of course, that means there's a number of things a Contoso user cannot do, show you that. I'll go ahead and show you that. You know, I can't save the document. I can't print the document. I can't send the document to somebody in email. I can't even copy and paste the document from the window. So in a federated world where access gets so much broader, the idea of still being able to have this sort of fine-grained control over specific things can address issues like security or regulatory compliance issues that organizations might have. So anyway, what we've done here today is we've had a little brief review of how Active Directory and WinFX can help organizations to leverage the rich services of Active Directory to provide identity and access in their applications, basically building identity-aware applications for a service-oriented world. And by leverage, because WinFX makes it so easy to do this, ultimately Active Directory can help organizations address some of the bigger identity and access issues that you were talking about before, like regulatory compliance or extending to business partners, et cetera.
And the key that we're doing here is we're building these things using the same WinFX-based foundations, the same WSStar protocols that are available to you as you build web service-based applications. Identity is a web service. Active Directory is an instantiation of that web service. Active Directory is broadly used today, and as these new services come online, it provides more and more capabilities for you to take advantage of as developers. There's things to do today. There's a lot more to do tomorrow.
That's right.
Great. Thanks, Dave.
Thanks a lot.
So as you can see, Active Directory, certainly identity, security, those are key things that we spend tons of time focusing on. The security problems that people are facing today have moved from being just these broad virus spread, things that are spread broadly, to being things that are targeted at individual companies. And being able to provide within the platform a set of services that enable you to secure the information of your customers is a key part of what we're developing. And as developers, it's really critical that we understand these things and take and build our applications using these facilities. Okay, Longhorn, 2007. Vista will ship in 2006. Longhorn will take a little server, Windows Server Longhorn will take a little longer to bake. We're planning on shipping this in the 2007 timeframe. There's a lot of things in Longhorn. I'm going to focus today on really just a few of the developer-focused things that are coming in Longhorn Server. Before I do that, let me just say that today we're, you know, today as a part of the goods, the things that are available to you, we are handing out the first availability of IIS 7 and an updated copy of Windows Server Longhorn. So that's something that's now available for you to add to your goods kit. So that's a new thing that's coming today. It's a new set of bits that's really worth taking a look at, and we look forward to seeing this evolve with more community technical previews over the coming months. Developer services in Longhorn. A lot of things, a lot of new capabilities that are being built into this base platform. Let me highlight a few of them. I talked about access for terminal services and remote applications across firewalls. This is a key thing because it really enables developers to build applications that can be projected anywhere. So they can run on the desktop, they can run in a Windows environment, they can also run from the server anywhere. They can take advantage of the new capabilities that are being built into Longhorn as well. Storage, a lot of things happening in storage. I'm going to highlight one, the transacted file system. TXF is an update to NTFS that simply put enables all file operations to be transacted. The great thing about TXF, yeah, it's very cool. The great thing about TXF is if you aren't using it, it has no overhead at all. If you are using it, the overhead is extremely minimal. Single digit percentages overhead. So it's very, very efficient from a file system perspective. What can you do? Begin transaction, copy file, move file, do this, do that, then either commit or roll back. The number of applications where this is interesting is very, very large. Certainly anything that coordinates files with other data stores, such as databases, and wants to do that in a transactional sense, finally, it's possible. Any application that wants to move a lot of files, we will use TXF as we do software deployment and patch deployment. We will use TXF so that if a failure occurs during the update, they can simply be rolled back. This is a very core foundational service. It's also a core service that will be used across SQL Server and WinFS and in other places moving forward. The event log, I'll just talk briefly about this. We're trying to get more information available from developers to operations and back to developers. A simple way to do that is make sure that information Metadata about an application's failure conditions and health state can be logged in the event log. The old event log API calls all still work. The new ones have extensions to allow metadata to be logged that provides a lot more information about the specific state of an application. So this is something we're building into the operating system, taking advantage of these metadata extensions for our own services. And as you build services, those are things that you can take advantage of as well. Longhorn, one of the attributes about Longhorn is its modularity, our componentization that we're doing. We're putting an enormous amount of effort into this major release to build a modular operating system. And this particularly applies on the server. Customers on the server often want to deploy just the set of core services that are required to run the role or workload that their application needs. So they don't want to have all these other features available if they're not using them. It reduces the surface area for having to patch. It reduces the vulnerability area. And it, frankly, makes maintenance simpler. So what we've done is we've built Longhorn in a way that is modular. And it's something that you need to be aware of as you build applications. There's something called a server core. It's the basic foundation for what's within Windows Server. And on top of that, there are a set of roles, a set of services that can run. Things like networking, security, Active Directory, management. Those are all services that can run simply on top of the server core. Perhaps you'll have applications you'll develop that can run here. This is an environment that has no graphical UI. It's a very, very basic Windows kernel plus basic set of services. And we think it's a great thing that our customers are going to want. Then on top of that, we build the what we call the Core Plus, which really adds a broad set of Windows Server capabilities that would typically run there. That's where you bring in the shell. That's where many other server applications would want to run because they want some of those services. And then there are even steps on top of that bring in the full set of client features if you want to, say, run a full terminal server to actually emulate a desktop. But most servers won't be deployed in that mode. Most will be deployed either with Server Core Plus providing this broad set of services or just the server core itself, and particularly in enterprises. So take that into mind that Windows Server Longhorn is modular, and as you build your applications, think about that. IIS 7. Major new release of IIS coming here. This release also is modular. One of the key things in IIS is its modularity. The fact is that the monolithic nature of IIS, which has been a total pain for people building applications, has been eliminated in this release. IIS is now built with a set of modules, with standardized interfaces, public interfaces. That's how we do extensibility. That's how you can do extensibility to IIS. We'll show that in a demo in a few minutes. IIS is built on a standardized activation service, the Windows Activation Service, that is how we activate either web-based protocols or WS Star-based protocols. So we're building in a standardized service to allow communications-based applications to activate higher-level services such as IIS or such as the WinFX Communications Foundation. ASP.NET is integrated in IIS 7 in a deeper way than before, allowing for applications that take advantage of ASP.NET things to not require the full set of ASP.NET services. And finally, IIS 7 has a very, very thorough set of diagnostics and tracing information, so you can pinpoint when something is going wrong with a web application that you've built precisely where that's happening in your code and can work to get that resolved as quickly as possible. With that, what I'd like to do is invite Bill Staples up to give us a demonstration of IIS 7, of all these great things that are coming in IIS 7. Bill.
Hey.
Morning.
Thanks, Bob. It's great to be here today. IIS 7 is a big release for us, and it's great to be able to show the work we've done in direct response to developers. Essentially, what we've done that I'd like to show off today is how we've taken the rock-solid security and reliability of IIS 6 and melded it with the kind of modularity that Apache is known for, and the power and ease of extensibility of ASP.NET. The result's a web server platform that offers much better integration across the stack and the same security, reliability, and management that IIS is known for today. So let's go ahead and show that off. What I've done is basically built a really simple website to help demonstrate the IIS 7 features I want to highlight today. You'll notice it's got a home page. I've named that billshome.html, style sheet, some images, and et cetera. But when I go ahead and pull up that website, you see, instead of getting the home page, I get this ugly error. Now, why? Well, IIS doesn't recognize my home page, Bill's home, as a default document. If this was any other version of IIS, I'd have to be a machine administrator to change that setting or any other IIS setting. Why? Well, today IIS configuration is stored in the metabase, which is a machine-centric administrator-only share, which is not very convenient for me, a developer, because I have to be a machine admin to change even a basic setting like default document.
Let's face it, the metabase is a pain in the butt.
Yep, and I'm happy to say with IIS 7, the metabase is dead. Instead, we've got the ability to create web.config files. Now, those ASP.NET developers out there automatically recognize this file, right? It's the same configuration system that's used today by ASP.NET. It'll be used across the web platform. IIS uses it, ASP.NET will use it, and Indigo uses it as well. So all configuration data is now stored in the same place, accessible via the same set of APIs. Now, the cool thing about this is I can come in here as a developer and go ahead and change my default document. Let's do it instead of index.html, let's do build.home.html. Go ahead and save that change. And now we can check out my site. Now, are there any bloggers out there?
Yeah.
Okay, a few. And maybe some press. Well, I'd really like to help you write an article on IIS 7. So I had them take a picture of me backstage right before I came out so that you can have a picture of me up on your article about IIS 7, I hope. Here we go. There we go. Is the resemblance not uncanny? That's how I felt right before that I came on stage, a demo monkey. That's what I feel like today. All right, so let's get back to business. I've changed the default document simply by editing a text file in my content directory. That's pretty simple, but it actually enables some pretty powerful things. It means when I get ready to hand off this site to operations, I can give them the code, the content, and my configuration. I don't have to spend an hour on the phone describing to them how to set up IIS to make it work with my application. It also means when they get ready to scale out the website across the server farm, they don't have to worry about metabase replication anymore. They can take the code, content, and config, put it on a Windows file server, and have multiple front-end web servers reference that configuration data as well as the content. Pretty cool stuff, but that's just configuration. Let me go on and show some of the componentization work we've done. What I've got here is a list of all the modules that we're going to ship with IIS 7. Now, you may not realize this, but all of these features today exist in IIS in a single DLL. Essentially, we have a private interface that we've built all of the core IIS feature set on top of, and then we've made ISAPI, the public interface, available to all of you. Well, with IIS 7, as Bob said, that's going to change. We have a brand new Win32 API that we're introducing that's a superset of ISAPI filter and extension capability. And we're taking it so seriously, we've ported all of the IIS features on top of that public API. That means you have the same API, the same fidelity that the IIS development team has for building new IIS features. Now, it also enables something even more powerful. It means each of these features of IIS are now implemented as a discrete module, this discrete binary on the box. What that enables is it enables me as a developer to customize the surface of IIS to fit my application needs. So in our case, we've got all the modules. I've made them an explicit part of my site's configuration data. I can show the site still works as expected. But we can come back and say, you know, did we really need that CGI module loaded for my site? I'm not using CGI. Let's get rid of it. Do we really need ISAPI or access checking? No, it's an anonymous website. In fact, you know, just for fun, let's go ahead and clear all the modules in this list. I've left this clear tag here in the module list. That basically clears inherited configuration. So with that, I'll go ahead and save the change and watch this really carefully because it goes by fast. That is the most secure and high-performing web server Microsoft has ever built. Now, it's not terribly functional, so let's go make it work again. You'll notice the first module I've got listed here is the anonymous authentication module. That basically allows anonymous users to access the site. Default document serves up that builds.home.html. The stack file module is probably self-explanatory. It spits back the static files I have as part of my site. And directory listing serves back that gallery link that I had. But everything else I don't need, so let's go ahead and trim down this list. So we're left with these four modules. Go ahead and save that configuration. Come back to our site, refresh, without rebooting or restarting IIS. Configuration is applied. And the big difference here, obviously, is instead of 40 modules, I now have four modules for this website.
Four modules to maintain, four modules that are kept up to date, so much more.
Four modules loaded in memory, four modules to patch. Yep, much better experience. Now, the next thing I wanted to show, though, is how we're taking the componentization even further. I mentioned we have a new Win32 API. We want to make extensibility as easy and powerful as possible. And so we want to make it available for ASP.NET, for managed code developers, basically. What we've done, instead of inventing yet another managed API to offer this, we've taken the existing ASP.NET extensibility interface, the IHP module interface, and we've plugged it directly into this new IIS pipeline. That means whether you're writing C, C++ code against our new Win32 API, or C#, VB.NET code against the existing ASP.NET interface, you can now plug directly into IIS, intercept every request, and do some pretty powerful things. For example, the ASP.NET Forms Authentication module that I've just plugged in here is implemented on top of that public interface. So are these others, role management, URL authorization. Now, these are features today that work great for ASP.NET applications. If you have an ASP.NET pages, you can do Forms Authentication against that page. And it's a pretty powerful feature. But now I'm plugging that same module that exists today directly into IIS. That means any request that comes into IIS, whether it's a classic ASP application, static file website like what I have right now, or even, you know, a PHP application, they can take advantage of ASP.NET Forms Authentication. So let's go ahead and actually show that off with my static file website. I'm going to go ahead and grab some additional configuration that I need to plug in to configure the site for Forms Authentication. And the last thing I need to do is actually create a login form. I've actually already created that for expediency's sake. Go ahead and open it up. You'll notice I didn't even have to write any code for a login form. That's the great thing about ASP.NET 2.0. They have a login control, completely declarative. I don't have to figure out what the identity system is I'm going against. That's all configured in the membership as part of the membership system. Login control implements all the access checking functionality, everything for me. So I've got the login form deployed. Let's go ahead, refresh the site. Get the login form, as expected, even though it's a static file website. Go ahead, log in now with the user I pre-created for demo. And there we go. We're authenticated, and we're in. Now, that's how we're making ASP.NET even more powerful and building on top of IIS 7. Of course, the last thing I wanted to show, though, is how you can use these extensibility APIs to actually replace IIS functionality. So if you don't like the way we do logging, you want to log against the SQL Server or your own XML log file format, you can take out the IIS module, plug in your own. If you don't like the way we do authentication, maybe you want to do basic authentication against an LDAP store or against some other database, you can now implement your own basic authentication module, plug it directly into IIS. Now, I'm a photographer, and on the side, of course, and I like pictures. So when I looked at this directory listing of some of my favorite images that I've taken, I was a little disappointed, honestly. This looks pretty much the same in IIS 7 as it did in IIS 6 and 5 and 4 and 3 and 2 and 1, for that matter.
So what could you do about that?
I can actually replace this built-in module with my own. Let's go ahead and do that. I've got the built-in module here, directory listing module. Replace it with dirlist module. I implemented mine using the ASP.NET IHP module interfaces, so I have to give it a type. Next thing I'm going to do is configure a couple of handlers that I also built, and I'll explain what those do in just a minute. Go ahead and plug those in to my configuration. Last thing we do is actually deploy the module, so I'll go ahead, drag this bin directory, xcopy deployment of the module and the handler. Now we can come back to our directory listing. Again, without restarting the server or anything else, I've just deployed a new module. And when IIS gets the request, instead of the built-in module getting it, my module gets it and puts out much better-looking HTML.
Great. So IIS is quite a great, really great stuff. Thanks a lot, Bill.
Thanks. Yeah. Thanks, Bob.
When I think about the combination of Visual Studio 2005, together with the Communications Foundation, IS7, I think those sets of services really provide the richest application platform on the planet to develop the most sophisticated web and web service-based applications. So we're very excited about the opportunities that exist for all of us to build great solutions built on top of this platform. Now, on top of all the other things we're doing in Windows, we're also putting a lot of focus on virtualization. And we have a lot of investments. Today, we have virtual server and virtual PCs. We have an important virtual PC. We have an important update to that coming. All of you have a production copy of virtual server that you can use as a part of your development process. But after we ship Longhorn, we will be building a hypervisor and virtualization capabilities directly into the Windows Server operating system. So we're actively working on building a new set of technologies that are from the ground up, designing a very modern hypervisor as a part of Windows Server to allow for virtualized sessions. Stay tuned. We have a lot more to talk about with regards to virtualization in the coming months. But be aware, we have a very, very competitive virtual server product available today. You all have it as a part of your kits. And we are building virtualization capabilities very, very deeply into the operating system as a core service for you to build applications on top of. So there's a lot happening over the next 3 years with Windows Server. We talked about R2 this year. We talked about 2006 with WinFX, Compute Cluster, Monad, and 2007, of course, Longhorn Server and these virtualization capabilities. Being successful with this is really, of course, all up to you. And in order for you to be successful, you need the software. That's why we're delivering the goods, so to speak, the goods with the CDs that you already have. You might notice that when you got your goods CD case, there was a CD missing. Well, that's CD 6. Disk 6 for the PC, and that's available today, and I very strongly encourage you to take that and add it to the set and start working on it. Hopefully you've been working at home, back in your hotel rooms at night on some of these CDs, taking a look at it. Maybe you've worked it through CD 2 or CD 3, but let's get to CD 6. All sorts of things coming in Windows Server. I talked about management and how SDM and management packs are available now, and Monad, how Monad will change things. Compute Cluster Edition, available in beta today, so you can start building applications here. And of course, WinFX, which is available to you as a part of the PDC material that we've given you to help build the next generation of distributed web service applications. We're very excited about all this. Now, you may notice that I've gotten to my last slide, and I haven't said anything about 64-bit. Not a single thing. Why is that? Because everything we're doing in 64-bit. 64-bit is here today. Windows Server will move very, very aggressively to 64-bit. Everything that we're building as we move forward, we're building in a 64-bit world. All of these services are available for 64-bit applications. And we are incredibly excited when we take a look and see what's happening in real-world deployments with 64-bit. We said that 64-bit would run 32-bit applications well. It is. 32-bit, your existing 32-bit apps run great on Windows Server 64-bit. We also felt that for data-oriented applications like databases, we would see phenomenal performance improvement. We are. The numbers are phenomenal. But we didn't really realize is the breadth of applications that when run in a memory-rich environment where you go beyond 2, 3, 4 gigabytes of memory, the kinds of performance we're able to see. MSIT is seeing phenomenal performance improvements on web server-based applications by running them in 64-bit and throwing more memory into it. As we move forward with Windows Server, I really think of 32-bit as legacy. We're going to be compatible and support that legacy, but the future is all 64-bit. The future is all the work that you're doing. I appreciate all your support. Thank you very much. Have a good day 3 at PDC.